I used to love Roseanne, man. She blocked me on Twitter. That bummed me out.
I'm Sean Cannon. That's Hari Kondabolu. And I think he's doing all right now. You should probably check on him, though. From Louisville Public Media, it's The Guest List. Steer into it.
This is bigger than you. Let me show you what I mean.
Look at what you look like. Look at you.
And I knew what he meant. I know what I look like, you know. I look like a Muppet getting his PhD. Like I...
It's 2042, Gary. You've never seen a hologram?
I get accused a lot about being obsessed with talking about race. People say, you're obsessed with talking about race. You're obsessed with talking about race. Really? In America, I'm obsessed with talking about race in America? Do you know who would disagree? Trayvon Martin's parents, probably. I think Oscar Grant's family would disagree. I think anybody in Guantanamo and their families would disagree. I think anybody who's a victim of racism every single day in America would agree that I am not obsessed with talking about racism in America. Accusing me of being obsessed with talking about racism in America is like accusing me of being obsessed with swimming when I'm drowning, all right?
When some folks encounter the work of comedian Hari Kondabolu, whether it's on his stand-up albums, like his last one, Mainstream American Comic, seeing him live in a club, watching his documentary, The Problem with Apu, or devouring his brand new Netflix special, Warn Your Relatives, they might say, oh, this guy does political comedy. Thing is, he kind of doesn't do political comedy. And he's just talking about living life day in and day out. And that's the thing. We have this strange dichotomy between politics and personal life. It's easy, especially if you're a middle-class white person like me, to forget that that division isn't real. The personal is the political. And that's what makes Hari's work so powerful and so funny, even when it feels uncomfortable for everybody in the room. You know, he's not lobbing one softball Trump joke after another down home plate. He's talking about living real life day in and day out in the context of the United States of America. You know, his work has only become more powerful as he's felt the need to become more personal on stage. That's actually something we get into in this conversation, but before we get into that, and before we get into his love for All in the Family, his thoughts on the Roseanne reboot, and his desire to make everyone on the political spectrum a little uncomfortable, we start things out with Hari talking about the mechanics of writing material, specifically for his new Netflix special, which is out now.
The best part is the initial, when you actually think of the joke, because it has all the potential in the world, and it's completely, like, it's your imagination, like, where could this go, you know? And then you have to do the work, and that's harder than just imagining, obviously. So there's that initial rush. Then there's the creating the joke, trying to make it work, and then it being polished. So they're different things. I mean, I like trying out material, but I prefer trying out material all at once in like Seattle. I'll rent a 40 seat venue, do four shows, do a complete new hour of material, and take a beating. Like, take a beating in front of people that like know what I'm doing. And it's like, okay, he's working through stuff. Cause you know, the most exciting thing is when you're writing on stage and all of a sudden a joke is fixed or you figure it out. And plus, like, when you're writing in large chunks, I mean, that's what an hour really is, right? You're writing in the segues already. You're trying to figure out structure. When you're doing jokes like 10 or 15 minute sets, working out stuff, you might do one or two new jokes and there's the old jokes to keep it up, you know, but that's, you get stuff done, but just a lot slower. And I like writing in big chunks because that's what I'm going to do. I don't want to do 10 or 15 minute sets forever. You know, like, I want to do hours and do 10 or 15 minutes. That's when I have to. I build for the hour. So I love that. I love having an hour and really trying to experiment with stuff I don't know where it's going to go. I mean, it's not quite like Rory Scovel. Like, I'm not going to go up there with absolutely nothing and make magic. Do you know what I mean? Rory's magic. I don't have that. But like, with a bunch of bits and premises and things that have some bullet points but no real structure, maybe a punchline, and the rest I got to discover, That's really exciting. But when I'm doing a headlining set somewhere at a club or something, it gets trickier because it's not a crowd that expects you to do new stuff. They want to see a good show. They don't care what you're doing. So in those situations, you have to have enough stuff in there that can carry the weight. And you slip in the newer concepts or the things that are going to hit some people more than others because you're trying to develop them. And you have enough laughs around it to give you momentum into the new stuff. So it's a little less fun. Like right now, you know, I'm doing shows where the shows are good, but I know I could kill it every one of these shows if I wanted. But I'm like holding back because, no, you already know that stuff works. You already know. That's why it's out already. You know, it's coming out. You don't need to, you know. And it's hard because when you're up there, you're like, I could be killing for an hour and I am choosing to have a less than optimal set because this stuff is never going to get worked out otherwise, you know, and that's what you got to do. And I think if you're strong enough, you can carry it through it and the audience doesn't know the difference. You know
sure.
What I mean?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, when you said, well, my favorite is to like rent a tiny theater in Seattle and then just take a pummeling. I'm like, oh, he's a sadist. And then you're like, but it's because of this. I'm like, oh, he's not a sadist. You know, I choose to do this every night. Oh, he is a sadist. So
right. Well, because in those situations, you know, when you're doing the hour of new stuff, the first show is the most brutal.
Yeah.
And the last show is the least fun because it's a little more polished because you've been repeating the same stuff. But that's like somewhere between the first and third show. That's where it's really exciting because you don't know where it's going to go, but you're starting to figure it out. And then all of a sudden you repeat the thing the first time after you did it the first show. All of a sudden these connections are being made because you're more comfortable with the wording. So it's just like it's open space and you're trying to find the thing. Or also you write a couple of jokes or punchlines between the shows because, you know, you just tried it once and your brain's activated. Like there's all sorts of really exciting stuff that happens in that space. And you're not worried about, oh, they're not getting the best show ever. They know what they're getting. They know what they came for. You know, it's made explicit. And I'm privileged that I can do that because I have enough of an audience, especially in certain cities, and where I have a history of doing this, where they know this is when he does this kind of night. This isn't the finished product. This is to see the sausage getting made. And that's how I like to do it. But it's brutal. And there's some of those shows you leave and you feel hopeless because you're like, oh, like this stuff isn't as good. And then the next show, all of a sudden they start to come together and you're like, okay, this is part of it. You know, it's weird because I recorded the special, the Netflix special. And when I was preparing for the Netflix special, I stopped doing the new stuff I was working on because I had to get to the polished set.
Right.
And I just said, okay, I'll go back to the new stuff I started writing when I get back. So I'm trying to get back to it. I forgot how they go. You know what I mean? Because it's been so long. I wrote the thing. They were working, and now I have no idea. I'm listening to old tapes. I don't remember why I got excited about it. It's weird.
Well, it's like I've seen some bands that like I haven't played this song in a long time, so I'm gonna like I have the lyrics and they have to apologize for that. But it's
yeah.
Like, wait, you played this song for 10 years. Stop playing it for 2 years, and now you're like,
that's how quick it goes out of your head, though. It's so fun. People, I got my first ever encore. I was in Honolulu doing a show, and I do this set. They asked me back on stage. I didn't know what was happening because they were yelling something that it wasn't in English, and so I asked, like, what's going on? Is that a good thing? They're like, they want you to come back out. And I've always dreamed of doing an encore, and I always knew which joke I would do if I was in that situation. But it was an old joke. It's my old white chocolate joke. And I got back on stage. I got a little flustered. I forgot how the whole thing went because I hadn't done it in years. Like, it's really funny. Like, it goes right out of your head when you're going on to the next thing. It's that quick.
Ah, man, that's fun. How often, how many encores have you done since then?
No, that's it. I never expect it. When does that happen when a comedian gets out to that?
I was wondering.
It doesn't really happen. Like, we finish our set.
I've never personally talked to a comedian who's like, oh, yeah.
It's nuts. It's like, because you expect the most you expect is an immediate standing ovation. That's the best. And then there's the delayed standing ovation where everyone else gets pressured because a bunch of people are. Then there's like the partial standing O's where some people are and some people aren't. And then there's just a good applause and all that. But like a encore, that doesn't happen in comedy. It's not like you can just play come out and play a bunch of hits, you know, or I guess you can do that. I mean, that's what I did essentially. I played the joke that was my best joke for a long time, but yeah, it's a very bizarre experience. It's just strange. It felt good, but it was strange. I don't know if it'll ever happen in my lifetime, but it happening once was so beautiful.
Oh, I can imagine. You're like, I should just quit comedy.
I felt like a musician. That's the sad thing. It's not even like I felt like a comedian. I felt like a musician. The peak of comedy is feeling like a musician, apparently, because I had to go back out. The crowd was cheering when I came back out. It was nuts.
Well, I mean, you already, when was that?
That was last month.
Oh, okay. So, I mean, you've already put out like 2 records on an indie rock label. So you're basically like.
I guess so. I guess that's, I never thought about that. You're right. I do have like, I do have 2 records out on a rock label, and it does feel like, all right, let me play some of the hits. Because I guess I have more legitimacy there, but strange, man. It was strange. It was great, but.
Well, then they're also like, oh, man, his little brother's a famous musician. So, right. Yeah, of course, we'll just treat him the same way.
God, I wonder if that was it. It was funny. Some people do ask me, because he had such a funny part in that band at Death Race, because he was the hype man. So it's a really weird, it's like, oh, your brother's songs. I'm like, he's not actually on any of the records, but they are his songs. I mean, but. I don't know if they've ever had that. Oh, no, wait. They do. Of course they've had that, because that's the thing all musicians do. They leave prematurely because they want the people, people want them to come back out. And then they do the fake encore where they do the songs that obviously they were going to end with, because how did you miss those big songs? It's like, okay, we'll do them here.
Now, a band I actually have a great deal of animosity for, of course, is Weezer, right? I hate Weezer. I used to love Weezer when I was a young person. They've done nothing but disappoint me. Now, if you're not familiar with Weezer, don't worry, but I'm sure if you're familiar with the idea that there might have been a band or an artist in your youth that you loved, and as you got older, they continually disappointed you, right? The classic example are the Rolling Stones, right? The Rolling Stones were once the greatest rock band in the world, but to see the Rolling Stones in concert now is like seeing the body's exhibit to music, right? It's a different.
How does it feel doing comedy like at this point in your career where now people know who you are? And not to say that you're like a super ridiculously famous one. You're not Kevin Hart, but you're also not like when I found out about you, speaking of your brother, somebody was like, oh yeah, it's the dude from Das Racist's brother. And I'm like, which one of the dudes? I don't know. One of the dudes. But now you're like, you know, you got the documentary, you know, you did the stuff with Come Out, like.
Right, 2 records out.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, it's weird. It feels a little transitional. It feels like, okay, it's not completely, like, I know my peers who are at a level where they sell out every venue, and it's not that. But it's not like I'm walking in with a crowd that doesn't know who I am. Like, it's always, there's going to be a critical mass of people at every show that know who I am. And that's new. It's new to know that there's at least some minimal support. And even at the worst show, there are people that like have obsessively seen my stand up. And enough where like I can hear a ton of people laughing either way. Like that's new. Like that's not, before it was always like, all right, if this was a bad show, those 5 people will come back later with 5 of their friends or whatever. And now their friends have come with them and they're bringing their friends. And so it's pretty great. And I mean, some shows in certain cities are always going to be a warm hug, you know, like a big, warm, like beautiful embrace, like Oakland or Seattle or Portland or, you know, New York, Boston, Chicago. There's just some DC. There's just cities, you know, like this is going to be piece of cake and it's going to be fun and it's going to be hanging out with a bunch of friends I haven't met yet. You know, it's great.
Yeah.
And then there's the cities where it's like that transitional half and half where you're not just playing offense. Like you're playing offense and defense. You're doing what you want to do when you can. And the rest of the time you're on guard. You're reacting to silence, or you're reacting to people, or you're reacting to awkwardness. And, you know, both those instincts are there and have to be used.
So you can't be LeBron James. You have to be Michael Jordan.
Yeah. Like you mean like my will just can't be.
Yeah. You got to be really good at defense too.
Oh yeah. You have to. I mean, I think that's good, man. Like, you know, I never want to be in a situation where I play to fans only and they laugh at everything and I'm not on my heels. At some point you had to be on your heels a little bit, because I think it's Simon Munnery, who's British. Mm-hmm. He said this. If the audience is behind you, you're facing the wrong way. And I love that. I love that. Like, you know, of course you want the audience to support you, but if they're constantly if you're not challenging them at all, if there's no oppositional relationship at all, what's the point? Because no one, like, not all my ideas are going to be agreeable. Like in this special, like I'm definitely making fun of the white liberal and I'm making fun of the idea of, you know, how people view change. And I'm making fun of people that would traditionally be my base. Mm-hmm. And it's important to do that. On my first record, I had this whole bit about the idea of the liberal coward that cries about going to Canada. Like, you know, some people didn't like that, you know, but it's true. It's like we talk about Canada in this way and it's like, what are we doing? It's not, they have a lot of f-ed up there too. And I think that it's, I think that's important. Whatever it is, you have to make sure people are never too comfortable. I love the Netflix special. I love the fact there's a lot of moments where people will cringe. Even the people that like me will cringe. And yet there's a point to it. Like to me, that's so much fun, that discomfort, that cringe that leads into a point. Because you, even though, like somebody said, you know, recently that it's like, I thought I was on your side, but you made me feel uncomfortable throughout and I didn't know how to feel, but I liked it. Like, I like how weird that interaction was. I like the fact that you're on your toes. And I also like that the, I feel like the folks that don't like my stand up or they don't like my political view. I should say that, who don't like my political views or call me a snowflake, like, watch my stand up. Like, can you say that really? You can't say, because there's right. There's people that like me or who are very uncomfortable. Like, that's good. So it's not like just a home run every time. Some of those are really tough at bats. And I got a single that I earned out of it, you know, and that's part of the game.
Well, it's, you know, like I understand what you're saying and it makes sense, but there is a certain part of it that in a, you know, in a way makes no sense because your goal is to like be able to do what you want as a comedian.
Yeah. Yeah.
But like in doing so, what you're saying is like you get weak, you get fat, you get lazy. And, you know, you're saying like, oh yeah, the goal of any comedian is to feel like a musician. Well, a musician's job is to make sure everyone loves them all the time.
It's weird, right?
Yeah. And so yeah, it's yeah, like, yeah. You're like, well, in order to do my job,
you gotta
well,
stay
people
sharp,
have to hate
though.
Me.
You gotta like, stay sharp. You gotta stay sharp. That's the thing. You can't, you gotta stay sharp. You have to find, and I'm not saying that means like some comments like I'm going to kill in every room. I'm going to go to every room and kill. I'm not saying that.
Right. Right.
Cause I think then you get soft in another way. You know what I mean? Like, you know, either you're pandering or you're not, you know, you're, not challenging yourself. To me, it's like, I don't mind playing for people that historically have liked me and who've learned, you know, seen my stuff and are now liking me. But I don't want it to just be like, I want there to be at least a couple of moments where they're confused by the point of view or I'm going one way and misdirect them somewhere else. Like, even if at the end of the day, I end up where they think I was going to go, I don't want that journey to be linear because then that's boring for everybody. Yeah. It's boring for me. Like as a comic, like, I don't want it to be so, like, what artist wants it to be simple? The fun of art is that you're challenged to make something and to make something that, you know, this is a tree. See, it looks like a tree. You like trees? There's a tree. You know, that there, I guess there's room for that kind of direct observation. But, like, when you're seeing a Picasso or you're seeing something that's more of an interpretation, you know, and I'm not saying it in the way of, like, complete alti, five people laugh, like complete abstract art. I'm not saying that, but the idea that things are symbolic and they have a larger point, like why that's not so direct and is still fun.
Yeah, you're like actually contributing something to a dialogue and not just.
I'm a critical populist. I mean, if I had to come up with anything, that's what I am. Like, I still want them to laugh, but I'm critical about what they laugh at and how they laugh. And is it the kind of laugh I want? But I still want them to laugh. Like every comic does. Like even in a room where I know this is going to be a hard room and they're not into it, of course I still want them to laugh. I'm not going to pander, but of course I'm going to take out a joke from 10 years ago that's family friendly just to try to win them back. Of course I'm going to talk to them and try to get them to like me. Carmen Legale, I think Carmen, who's opening for me and a lot of this tour, it's usually Liz Mealy and Carmen Legale that open. But Carmen, she said something recently. She was saying how it's like you have to flirt with the audience. Every comic has a different, and sometimes it's like you insult the audience playfully. And it's like negging almost. And you have to like seduce them in a way. And that's what it is. And even when it's a rough show, part of you is still like, I'm going to win them. I'm going to get them. This audience is you know, is really putting up this, like, I'm not into you, I'm still going to try to flirt as much as I can. And it's a really interesting way to look at comedy. I think Carmen would be okay with me sharing that. So I mean, I really love it. There is a flirting. It's like, how do I get you, like, the, you know, you're on stage and there's these audience members that are not laughing. And then they finally break a smile and then they finally laugh. I try not to focus on them because that's a bummer. But out of the corner of my eye, I'm like, yeah, gotcha. Took 15 minutes, but I gotcha. Let's see where this goes.
So there was an incident at this coffee shop, right? Right, again, this was in Seattle, and Seattle is a town full of white liberals. So the white liberals in this coffee shop did what white liberals tend to do when there's a confrontation. They put their heads down and pretended nothing was happening. Right? Don't worry, Hari, I'll give you a hug afterwards, though, okay? Gotta get my safety pin on. Gotta get my safety pin on. Gotta get my... Stop it! Stop it! Poke him in the eye with it. Be useful!
Well, so for you at this point in your career, like... So that's how it feels like as a stand-up, but as a business person, I guess, like in show business.
Yes.
Like, you know, my assumption is 5 years ago, your documentary would not have been made.
That's true. But both because of there wasn't a critical mass that would necessarily have supported, or the networks didn't know there would have been.
Right, right.
And also, you know, I don't think I had the... To use an industry term I hate, the juice.
Sure, but I mean, even if it was someone else 5 years ago.
Yeah, I don't know if it would have been.
Yeah.
I don't know if it would have been. I don't think we, I mean, I see the change in tone, and I see even the executives who understand the contemporary debates a lot more than they used to. And also, I think that, no, I think, you know what, I think a great way to look at it is the show that I used to write for Totally Biased with W. Kamau Bell. That show is about 3 or 4 years ahead of time because where we are now as a society in terms of what we talk about, whether it's Sam B or John Oliver, or, you know, whoever else is making, you know, critical commentary, whether it's talking about trans issues, whether it's talking about police brutality, we were doing that on our show with a great deal of aggression and passion 4 years ago. And now that's in. But at the time, people weren't quite, you know, there wasn't a critical mass to keep that show alive. So, you know, there is a sea change, or there's at least we're in the middle of it, or the beginning of it. We're somewhere where I can see people understanding more complicated ideas. And again, as a comic who wants to push further, that's fun. Like, that's fun for me because that means I can keep going with an idea, right? If people don't know what you're talking about, you can only go so far before, you know, you just run out. You know, you can't explain everything. But if they know more base stuff, you can keep going. That's really fun.
Well, so for you, like, as, you know, a person of color, like, how is it on that side of the...
So much better.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. I remember when I started in Seattle, you know, I'd performed for years in college and stuff. So it's not like, you know, a real crowd. I remember being on stage then, and even in a liberal place like Seattle's still really white. And you had people who weren't just like liberal Seattleites. You know, comedy club draws everybody. It's not like there's a comedy club in every suburb. You know, people want to go to the city to see comedy. And you know, you'd have people who liked me, liked my politics, like loved what I did. But there was also people who didn't understand how my voice came out of my face. Like, do you know what I mean? Like, why? Like, the idea that I'm also an American, I sound like this, I grew up in New York. That was such a foreign idea. Like, you understand it probably logically, but when the only thing you saw on TV was like a Apu and a handful of other characters, there is no reference. So that's 2005. And now you look at it now, there's so many more voices. There's a generation of young people that grew up with brown people. It's a little less shocking now. It's like, at this point, I don't need to fight that fight. I was talking to Aparna Nancherla about it. Aparna's like, we're like siblings. Like, I love Aparna. She's amazing. And Aparna was talking, you know, she used to have a joke she used to do. It's a great joke, but she'd come out and she'd say, yeah, I'm surprised I'm up here too. Oh, yeah. You know, yeah, I'm surprised I'm doing comedy too. And it's an acknowledgement that no one like her has existed. And so she almost has to say that. And we talked about how it was a funny joke, but it, you know, at a certain point for her, it just was, she hated having to say it because it was like, ugh, I have to explain myself. You know what I mean? And now she doesn't have to do that. She's a Aparna. You know, people, like, I remember comics loved her before everybody else did. I remember going to shows where the audience was so confused and we all loved her because like she was so like her writing is so incredible, both the short stuff and like these longer pieces that she, especially now, the stuff she's doing now, which is so incredible because it's also political in addition to brilliantly dry and observational and weird. But like the audience was almost like, okay, it's an Indian woman. She doesn't have an accent. She's talking on a stage. She has a high pitched voice. She's a woman that already people get weird about. And her and none of the angles are typical. So there's too many layers for them to understand what's happening. Like, it's just so like there's an alien on stage, right? And now she can go on stage and she kills it. People love her. It's about damn time. Like, that's progress, man.
This is a recent realization I made in my life. There is no way to pick up pills that you've spilled on the ground without looking like a total human red flag. You know, there's just no way to be like, oh! Oh, this is what I meant to do, and everything is going great!
I mean, she's such a, like, she's an original, man. There's really nobody like her, and I think in comedy and entertainment or anything, really, like, we want the next thing. And the next thing often... Now I feel like is the old thing that wasn't allowed to exist, you know, like, yeah. You know, Masters of None. It's a lot of old ideas for some of us. And he's addressing and it's public, or this documentary I did about Apu is, you know, for a long time was boring to me because I, you know, talked about it to death. And but at the same time, it was a 101 lesson that seemed necessary. So, I made this thing and it's so interesting and it excites people or angers people because it's new. The old story is the new story. Fresh off the boat, man. It was supposed to be Eddie Wong's show. Eddie's had such a complicated, fascinating life, but the show is, you know, it's a family sitcom, really. It doesn't sound like Eddie's life anymore, right? Because it's the Asian American family show that should have existed 15 years ago, but they didn't, you know, it wasn't allowed to exist, you know? Like, the old story is the new story because there's all these people that weren't allowed to talk. It's exciting. We have so many TV networks. We have so many, like, internet things. Amazon, Apple, Facebook. Everybody wants to get in on, the quote-unquote content game. So you have enough people that are creating stuff who finally get a chance because people will make money off it. It's not noble. It's, right. Do you know what I mean? It's not like when people say it's for the sake, you know, diversity is important. No, you found out that there's money in putting these people on. Yeah. And so you get a cut of their money, or they have a million subscribers on Facebook or on YouTube. It's like, oh, I didn't know. But of course you did. Of course you knew they were marketable. So it's I feel like we're in the middle of a golden age.
So for you, we're like, you know, I know that you've said in the past that you're not a political comedian.
Right.
Because, I mean, you do a lot more than that, but, you know.
Like, it's that weird thing where I never think, let me talk about politics now.
Right, that's what I mean, yeah. But, like, where are you at on that front, like, for the special? Like, is it...
I think it's more about the bigger issues, and I also make it a little more personal than I have historically.
Okay.
There's some stuff on the special that's family and stuff, and I think I'm talking more about family and personal stuff now as a result of pushing myself for the special. Ultimately, I feel like that has always been... a weakness for me in my stand-up that I want to change, which is giving more of myself. People, I feel like they know me because I'm vulnerable through the things I share in terms of political things. Because to me, they're not political, like I was saying. So you get me in the ideas. This is somebody who believes strongly in this. This is somebody who cares about other human beings, who cares about justice. But I don't ever tell people how I got there. I don't tell people like some of the stuff I went through because it's more vulnerable than just, you know, talking abstractly. That's why Pryor is like the best comic of all time still.
Right. Yeah. Oh God. Yeah.
He did everything. It's so funny. Like there's so many different comics who have elements of Pryor, like Marin, like how he bleeds on stage, you know, that's like, that feels like Pryor to me. Same thing with Maria Bamford in a different way, you know, character work. He did tons of characters on stage. He did voices. He talked about race, you know, he wrote with Paul Mooney. Like he wrote, you know, he talked about family, he did stories, like, he did everything. He was physical. He was verbal. It was wordplay. It was dirty. It was political and smart. Like, you know how they say that, like, every Beatles album created 1,000 different bands because their styles were so different? Pryor, I think, was the same way. And I feel like, okay, I'm doing this aspect. What about the part that bleeds? Like, I don't need to set myself on fire, but like there has to be those rock bottom moments and those things that have developed me as a human. I got to share those more. And it's scary, but that's really where I want to go. And I feel like this is the beginning. This is the toe getting dipped in the water in this special.
Okay. Well, I mean, you know, because the thing about when I think of Pryor is that, like, he did that because, like, he had to.
Yes.
You know, like, there was no way he could do anything else but, like, throw himself prostrate
on
the stage.
Remember, early on he didn't do that.
No, but he got to a point where it was very clear that he wasn't just doing it to, like...
He felt like he was putting on a costume. It wasn't him.
Yeah. And that's what I mean. It's like, it was very, very intentional, very purposeful, very, you know, the word I like to use is like vital.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, not just for him, but for the audiences. And so I guess what I'm getting at is, you know, you're saying, well, I need to put more of myself out there. Do you feel like for you at this point, it's a necessary thing? And I mean, and I don't just mean because of like, well, I need to give more of myself because I should, but like.
You mean like career wise?
No, I mean like existentially.
I feel it.
Yeah,
like
okay.
I feel like it feels not like you're lying, but it feels like you're withholding information when you're on stage.
Yeah, I guess that's what I'm asking.
Like it feels I want to talk about it. I want people to, you know, and I think it was my mom who said it. My mom's great, but she talks about how like if you tell them who you are, when you talk about these other things that might make them uncomfortable, they understand you better. It's like when you're talking to a friend, even if they disagree, they'll listen to you and maybe they'll change their mind. And either way, they're sympathetic because, well, I care about my friend. They have to care about you. And to care about people, when you know a bit more about a person, you care about them. You care about their lives. You care about what happens to them because they remind you of people you know. I mean, I think that's it. Like, you know, we're all not all that different. Human beings are not all that unique in certain ways. Like we have the same issues, heartbreak, depression, people dying, fears, like meeting money. It's the same stuff, man. That's a universal, and we all suffer, and each of our outlooks is a little different, and each of us have a different spin on how that looks and how that feels. I mean, but that's the stuff. If you can actually share that kind of stuff that's vulnerable, I think when I talk about, like, you know, imagine if you're also dealing with all these other factors and racism on top of that, or sexism on top of that. It's like, man, life's hard enough. Why are you giving me another hurdle? And I think that's, you know, that only makes sense if you're willing to share and people get you. Otherwise, it's like, why is this dude yelling at me? Why is he saying that? That's the flirting thing. That's where you got to give more of yourself. And I feel like that's important, man. That's really important.
Well, I guess too, for like when thinking about your career, I guess part of why I'm curious about that is, you've always been vulnerable, like you said, because you're talking about these things that other people don't talk about,
right.
Things that are like hard and scary to talk about.
Yes.
And so for a lot of comedians.
And those are easier to me in some weird way than talking about.
Well, I mean, I get that because it's still an app. Like you're like pulling yourself away from it by one step or two.
That's right.
But I know that, you know, like when I see the journey of a lot of other comedians, part of it is they do the thing where they're like, I'm funny. I want to be funny. And then at a certain point, they're like, oh, I also need to be vulnerable.
Yes. Yeah.
But you have been vulnerable, but in a, like a slightly different way, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So that's why I was curious if like,
yeah, it's not like I had a complete, cause I was going to mention that to you actually, just like how all these great comedians had that, like Lenny Bruce was super clean. And then he turned.
Yeah.
Carlin was super clean. Then he turned. Pryor was super clean. Then he turned. Hicks was super clean and goofy. And he like all of them had that. I guess for me, it's like, I was already pushing and vulnerable, but it was a different kind of vulnerability. But like there's growth in all these comics and all of them challenge like the status quo. Like Pryor is probably the biggest and most mainstream out of all of them, you know, and then probably Carlin. Right. But like all of them did that. All of them like had to challenge and make people uncomfortable. And they just felt ridiculous at a certain point not doing that. It's just like, what am I doing? That's like the thing I was telling you about. Just like, if they're behind you, you're facing the wrong way. It's like at a certain point, all of them, you know, even, you know, you listen to Carlin specials, he's not killing on every single thing.
Right, right, right.
Some of the things is just, they're challenging, and that's for him. And I've never heard someone say, it's self-indulgent crap. I've never heard that about Carlin. So there's always enough in there. And plus you're thinking, because sometimes the comic is ahead of the audience. by a year or two, you know, because society's not there yet. And now you listen to them like, that's brilliant. How come they're not laughing? Because they weren't there yet.
Right. Yeah. Well, that's one of the funny things. Just, you know, like being a fan of not just stand-up comedy, but like the history of it is weird to hear reactions in the past from people who, I mean, sometimes you say a year or two, sometimes it's like 4 or 5.
Yeah, right. Well, it's also weird to me when like comics complain about the whole political correctness thing and like these college kids or these college students. It's like, don't do that. At least don't verbalize it because you sound old. Don't you realize this is every generation is the kids these days? That's every generation. Like, if you feel that way, come to terms with it. But every time you vocalize it, it's like, man, you sound ancient because eventually you're going to be playing people that are your audience and they're dwindling. How else are you going to reach people who are younger? How else are you going to connect with them? You have to understand them. You might not understand them or agree with them right now, but you better figure it out. I don't get all the stuff. I don't understand Snapchat. I don't watch what they watch, but I need to understand why this is upsetting to them and this isn't. I need to understand, like, how are their feelings about, like sex and relationships and religion compared to how we grew up? Because if I don't get that, I'm out of the game. Like, I'm irrelevant. So every time I hear that, I'm like, at the end of the day, that's not going to be good for you.
I was doing a show in Denmark last year. I don't know why. But I got heckled in a way I'd never been heckled before. A man got up in the middle of my show, and he interrupted, and he said, "Hey, go back to America."
Wow.
It's amazing. It's amazing because I've been told to go back to so many countries.
Do you like All in the Family?
Yeah.
That's my favorite show, or one of the top three.
Okay.
I love All in the Family. And All in the Family, whenever there's an argument about political correctness, people say you can't make a show like All in the Family anymore. You can't like have a character like Archie Bunker. Now, first of all, I don't think that's a good example because there shouldn't be a character like Archie Bunker because people like that shouldn't exist anymore. That's the first point. Secondly, that came at a really pivotal time in America. So all those issues made complete sense in the way they were done. And also they weren't done for the sake of face value. That show is Archie Bunker is the on that show. He's like a weird hero. He's not really a hero. You love him. You sympathize him. You know he grows in these subtle little ways, but he's a jerk. And he's immediately contrasted with his younger, like, you know, daughter and his son-in-law and his wife, who's more open-minded than he is, right? He's the joke of the show. He's not the person you're supposed to look up to. That show is built to knock Archie down to make a point. That's brilliant. That's like so smart. And it's done with subtlety. It's done with thoughtfulness, especially for the time. Now you couldn't do some of those things because now some of those things feel old and hacky.
Yeah.
That just happens. So you're not supposed to make that show again. You're supposed to make the modern version of that show that's able to do the same things, but not in the same way because we've already moved past that. Like if Norman Lear was active today making stuff, he wouldn't make a show that looked like All in the Family. He'd make a show that made sense for now, but did the new things that you had to push. That's what you do.
Right. Yeah, you can't have an entire episode devoted to a guy saying, blackface is cool, right?
Right. It's so backwards. And what's the point of Archie saying all those slurs and stuff? Like the modern version of that, like there may be still some folks like that, but the modern version of that's more subtle. You know, it's more of a subtle racism that's more interesting. God, that I was talking to somebody else about this recently. I love that show so much. Like, you know, there was that episode where someone tried to sexually assault like Edith.
Yeah.
Like, I can't imagine a show like now that now tackling it with such thoughtfulness. There was a show. Do you remember that? Edith had a good friend who was a drag queen. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
Beverly LaSalle. And there was an episode. Do you remember the episode where Beverly LaSalle is killed in a hate crime, and then Edith stops believing in God? Like, are you? And it's a comedy.
Hey, little girl, what would you like for Christmas?
I want Beverly to be alive.
Oh, wait, oh,
I can't understand it. I mean, everything was going so good for him, and then somebody had to kill him.
Yeah, just because he was different.
Oh, I'll see you after church.
And it still managed to have funny moments. It was like whenever it got too much, the pressure, they released just enough.
Jeez, I wish she could get some cheering up someplace. You know? How many laughs are you going to get in an hour in church?
That's like mind-blowing television, and it's more thoughtful and progressive than anything I see now, I think. And that doesn't have to do with political correctness. That right. has to do with lack of guts.
Yeah, no, it's true. Because, I mean, at that point, the show was, I mean, clearly in terms of what it said, not politically correct, but also incredibly politically correct.
Yes,
the entire purpose was to show
exactly.
people, hey, you should think about other human yeah. beings sometimes.
Dude, that's exactly it. That's like, it's like the use, it's like the same thing. Like, I'm not against shock, but what's the difference for shock's sake and shock to make a point? Like, if you see All in the Family, you just see Archie Bunker, you miss the point. The show is not just about Archie. It's about progress and this guy being trapped in the past. That's why the show is brilliant. It's not just because of Archie.
Well, so I'm going to ask you a question then about someone who's become a bit of a lightning rod lately.
Tell me.
Roseanne.
Oh, man, that breaks my heart, man. It's complicated, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because Roseanne, that show was incredible, the original. And the last
that was,
season.
That was my life. Like, that show
yeah.
was exactly how my mom was a woman who worked her way to the point where
yes.
she could own a restaurant
yes.
and was a smart ass,
yes.
as was my dad, both working class people in a rural town, and watching that show. It was a show that I could watch and my parents could watch. And I mean, I told you how they felt about
Archie Bunker. My mom loved that show as well. Like it connected with America and introduced people to an America you don't always see.
Yeah.
Like my Indian immigrant mom loved that show. Like that's incredible to write a show like that.
So yeah,
I thought a lot about this. One, it's a bummer because the last episode of the series originally is one of the greatest last episodes of all time.
Yeah, I still haven't seen the reboot, so I don't know how they handle any of that, so I'm not going to ask. But yeah, yeah, I was bummed just to find out they were...
I mean, I will say if Dan's alive, it's already, you know. I mean, the last episode of the original series, I mean, I don't know that whole lottery episode and how they won the lottery in the original last
yeah.
season. I don't know if that was intentional in order to get to the last episode or whether they went on a terrible path and they found a brilliant series finale. But, you know, it had such heart, the idea of this is a woman that's mourning the loss of her husband and is trying to imagine a perfect life. And she's writing this book. And that's what the whole series was. And the ending is this way to try to, you know, find happiness in a really difficult situation. And you already see how hard their lives can be. And this adds to it, and it's so beautiful. Like, I just
yeah.
love that show. And also, all the characters were challenged in different ways. You know, like her sister is a liberal, and they have, you know, they have these different views and the open mindedness around gay rights and stuff in that show. So that show is so incredible. And then they reboot the show. And look, whatever. Like, I think Roseanne being a Trump supporter on the show, I think that's fine, to be
sure.
honest. But what's weird is, when you know Roseanne in real life is that person and what she said, she didn't keep her cards close to the vest. When you can watch that show and not know what she actually believes and how close she is to that character, the idea of satire works perfectly. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
Because you don't know. I didn't know exactly who she was by watching Roseanne originally. But now that I know, it kind of kills that ability to suspend disbelief. Because you think it actually is her because she said all these vile things about trans people and, you know, all these terrible things about immigrants and stuff. Like, you start to believe it, like the separation isn't there anymore. She took it away from us. And also she's bringing a show back on where we don't have that, like that boundary we used to have. I don't know, man. It feels weird.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and there's the fact that, like, again, I haven't seen any of the reboot, but my assumption is that nothing she says in the show is anywhere near as bad as what she said in real life.
Yeah.
You know, and that's the other part of it is it's not just like you don't know what she believes. It's like you see this character who is probably as likable as she was
right
in the original series, as far as like if you can divorce it from who she is
in real
life. Which
is weird because who she is in real life doesn't feel as likable as she used to be.
So like my assumption would be it's like the character is the same character as before for the most part, but it's not that character anymore. it's way worse. It's not just like, you know, that she really believes it. She's probably not going to say something like 9/11 was a false flag on the show.
Right. But you start to. Yeah. Yeah.
But you know that she's going to. I don't know if she said that specifically, but I imagine.
But there's
something
a little
close to
Alex
it.
Jonesy element there. That's.
Yeah.
A little, I mean, I used to love Roseanne, man. She blocked me on Twitter. That bummed me out. I don't even remember why. I think maybe I even just liked something that somebody she didn't like liked and she got rid of me. I don't even remember. I mean, that's fine because the stuff she's writing, if I read it, it's going to show up in the news because that's what seems to be happening. But,
sure.
But, you know, it was kind of a bummer. It's like because I've watched so much of that show, you know, and, you know, as I've discovered, sometimes shows that you love a great deal can disappoint you. So.
And now it's time for a guest DJ set from Hari Kondabolu, whose brand new Netflix special, Warn Your Relatives, is out now.
On the first song that I'd love for people to hear is the song Punching Myself in the Face Repeatedly Publicly by Sebado.
Tear a chain, I sure am sweet on you. I'm knowing how it feels to miss you bad. It's kind of weird to think I hardly know you when I feel like we're old friends.
I love it because the name of the song is so incredible. And also, it's such a lo-fi song that doesn't really feel like the title at all that I absolutely love it. Like, punching myself in the face repeatedly, publicly.
When it feels so good, did I want to come down and see you? Fly 1,000 miles to see your face. All I understand is I'm compelled. Knowing you with someone makes me feel like you.
The next song I'm going to request is Roadrunner by the Modern Lovers.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Roadrunner, roadrunner. Going faster, miles an hour. Gonna drive fast and stop and show up. With the radio on. I'm in love with Massachusetts.
I just think it's, especially as a touring comic, it's just a great song. I feel like I've come out, I've requested that song as entrance music a few times because there's times you're on the road for weeks at a time and it that's the song. That's exactly how it feels. I'm just on the road. I'm going from place to place. And plus, Jonathan Richman's a nut, and I love it. I love the fact, I don't even know if it's a character, if that's really him or not. But it, like, hearing his music, it's so earnest, which I can appreciate. It's so weird. I don't know if these are punchlines or his actual feelings. But yeah, definitely a Roadrunner by the Modern Lovers. The next song is A Tribe Called Quest's Scenario.
Here we go, yo. Here we go, yo. So what, so what, so what's the scenario? Here we go, yo. Here we go, yo. So what, so what, so what's the scenario?
I love Scenario. I actually slipped some lyrics from Scenario into my special. Most people don't catch it. I've noticed that at all the live shows. But the people that catch it lose their minds when they know that's what I'm referencing. So if you see my special and you hear the song, maybe you'll find it. It came towards the end and, you know, a couple of folks asked me whether I should cut it. And I was like, look, let me have a couple of these little Easter eggs for me. And I know it's towards the end, but I feel like it's a little prize for some of the folks who made it that far and they like it. I mean, I love Tribe and they're from Queens. And Fife had just died. And I listened to that album a ton, the new one, so it just felt good for me to slip that in there.
Don't sweat what you heard, but act like you know. Yes, yes, y'all.
Yes, y'all.
Who got the vibe? It's the Tribe, y'all.
Tribe, y'all.
Live, y'all.
Live, y'all.
Inside, outside, come around.
Who's that?
Brown. Some may I say.
What do you think about the new one?
I love
one?
It. I mean, I love the new album. Scenario was obviously one of the older ones, but like, I love the new album. I listened to the album a lot when I was preparing for the special. I definitely came out on stage to We the People a couple of times. It was really, it's a great record.
We don't believe you, cause we the people are still here in the rear, yo, we don't need you. You ain't killing off good young mother mood. When we get hungry, we eat the same plate of food, the ramen noodle.
You know, it's weird cause you don't hear Fife in a lot of the tracks. There's enough he recorded before he died, but you know, you when you hear him, it's beautiful and you're happy you have this recording. And when he's not in a song, you know he's not in the song. It's really beautiful, and it's really rare for a band to come back after a long period of time and still sound like them and still be relevant.
Yeah.
It's honestly, I think it might be the only example I can think of.
Is it getting a hood living in a fishbowl? Gentrify here, now it's not a shithole. Trend set up, I know, my shit's cold. Hand set up because I ain't so bold. But yeah, all you black folks, you must go.
I'm going to request Bull in the Heather by Sonic Youth. I love that song, like just the opening, like they have this, like how do I describe it? It's just them hitting cymbals, and plus it has a little, it's everything Sonic Youth did well. It's weird, and the lyrics I don't always get, but they're perfect. And I love the music video because Kathleen Hanna's in it, and she's so hilarious in it. And I'm like lucky enough where Kathleen's a friend of mine, and it's like, holy, yeah, it's like the most stunning thing, and I'm still so, I feel so privileged to be able to say that. So yeah, let's Bull in the Heather by Sonic Youth.
10, 20, 30, 40, tell me that you wanna hold me, tell me that you wanna bore me, tell me that you gotta show me, tell me that you need to slowly, tell me that you're burning for me, tell me that you can't afford me.
I'm going to request Gigantic by the Pixies. I love the Pixies. I love, you know, the contrast between Frank Black's ability to scream and how beautiful Kim Deal's voice is.
And this I know, his teeth is white as snow. What a gas it was to see him walk her every day into a shady.
That and just it goes with their whole like with loud, quiet, loud, and I feel like with my stand-up, that's I like that, the idea of like the explosion on the punchline, but how do you build so you lull them in? God, that, I mean, that band, the Pixies, have such an interesting history. I mean, I've always been fascinated by them. I'm like, I have like Pixies bootlegs from the 80s.
Oh, man.
On VHS, which really is worthless now.
Oh, man.
I was really into them. Yeah.
All right, man. Thanks for doing this.
Dude, no problem. This was a really fun conversation.
It's unbecoming of a gentleman to gush too much, so I'll just say that I'm a fan of your work.
Thanks, man. I appreciate that.
This is good. That's all of my conversation for today with comedian Hari Kondabolu, who has a new Netflix special called Warn Your Relatives. It's out now, and it's really funny. Well, that's all we've got for you this week here on The Guest List from Louisville Public Media. Stacey Owen is our executive director. Kojin Tashiro is our technical director. And we get special assistance from Margaret Darling. You can find everything we have to offer on our website, guestlist.wfpk.org. And hey, you're still listening at this point, which means you probably like us. So please go to iTunes and rate and review us, because it really does help. I'm your host and producer, Sean Cannon. You can find me on Twitter at Mr. Sean Cannon. And you can find these Mother of Pearl coveralls one place only. That's Red Cap. I'll see you next week. Steer into it.